Conducted by Henry Weber, written and directed by Jack LaFondre, Mutual presents the Chicago Theater of the Air Summer Concert Hour, a gala hour of music and song sincerely dedicated to better radio listening for your entire family. Featured highlight of this summer series is the career performance of a new vocal artist each week, a great opportunity for deserving young singers to start professional radio careers. Our stars this evening are Nancy Carr and Bruce Foote, our speaker, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, and our career performance guest, tenor Lawrence White. The Chicago Theater of the Air Summer Concert Hour. Into this summer night, an unbroken spell of exquisite music. Tchaikovsky, Malloy, Johann Strauss, and Gounod. Each a shimmering star in a great cascade of melody. The Tchaikovsky themes include highlights from his Sixth Symphony, None But the Lonely Heart, and scenes from the Romeo and Juliet fantasy. Then Malloy's picturesque Carry Dance, Tales from the Vienna Woods by Johann Strauss, and the dramatic Gounod Soldier's Chorus, and even Bravest Heart from Faust. Here is uninterrupted music for your summer night listening. Nancy Carr, Bruce Foote, Henry Weber, the chorus and the orchestra.
Thank you. the boys began to gather in the dread of a summer night. And the very night pursuing, they are swung with wild delight. Oh, to think of it, oh, to dream of it, fills my heart with tears. Whom did the
to glory shall call me, I still will be first in the fray, as bright as a night in his bridal array, as a night in his bridal array. Fairest of women,
spell of music for everyone, presented as the first section of tonight's Chicago Theater of the Air Summer Concert Hour, starring Nancy Carr and Bruce Foot, and conducted by Henry Weber. At this point in tonight's concert, it is our pleasure and privilege, as always, to present our distinguished speaker of this broadcast series, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, outspoken American patriot, and noted world historian. Tonight, Colonel McCormick will speak on the subject, Preface to War. Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Robert R. McCormick.
The War of 1812 was essentially an American effort to fight terror of European influence, imperialism, aggrandizement, and intrigue. It was a war fought against Great Britain, yet it might as well have been fought against France and against Spain as well. The War of 1812 was brought about by stupid and selfish European resistance to the assertion that the United States did, indeed, propose to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station as set forth in the Declaration of Independence. American insistence upon free trade and sailors' rights in the high seas was challenged by French and British blockades of American commerce and by the British impressment of American seamen. American occupation of the Northwest Territory was long delayed by the British retention of forts in the area in open violation of the treaty which concluded the Revolutionary War. On the high seas, British conduct was arrogant. On land, British trade, arms, and influences at work among the Indian tribes constituted a standing grievance. British machinations in the Northwest Territory menaced American frontier settlements for 30 critical years of the young republic. Fortunately, the Louisiana Purchase of 1803 superseded the Spanish and bought off the principal French threat to the Mississippi Valley by way of New Orleans. Yet most Western Americans well understood that the transfer might be repudiated by a victorious Napoleon. And the moribund Spanish colonial empire asserted shadowy rights to vast areas in the far west, maintained a disputed boundary with Louisiana, and claimed title to Florida. Through the fortunes of the European War, the Spanish claim to Florida was to become further involved in British intrigue. The most outrageous as well as the most costly interference with American maritime development arose out of the bitterly contested Napoleonic Wars. The British government, like the others, had long practiced the ancient principle of restricting its peacetime colonial shipping to vessels under the British flag. Moreover, Britain's powerful navy gave her a means of enforcing wartime blockades as well as peacetime restrictions. In time of war, the British maintained that neutral carriers trading with enemy colonials were, in effect, tacit allies both of the belligerent colonies and their homeland. The American government, on the other hand, sought to win international recognition of neutral rights and unrestricted commerce. The American Navy was mistakenly believed to be impotent to enforce its American claims. Napoleon's decrees and diplomacy made every effort to embroil the two Saxon powers. At first, through various devices, the United States won important concessions from British authorities in the matter of maritime trade and overseas shipments. Negotiations are too complicated to discuss here, and the fact that American trade in foreign affairs troubled during little more than a decade of fishing in troubled waters. Yankee merchants and shippers were growing rich. British merchant seamen began to desert British vessels to benefit by the better pay and better living conditions offered in the American merchant marine. The British answer to this state of affairs was a wholesale impressment of seamen from the American merchant service. The right of impressment, that is, the forcible enlistment of men in the Royal Navy, was jealously held prerogative of the British Crown. Applied to British subjects in England, many of them rogues and vagabonds, the practice was notoriously brutal and contemptuous of human rights. Applied to seamen found serving aboard vessels of American registry, impressment involved the belligerent search of a neutral vessel, and in the case of American nationals, a gross violation of the fundamental status of American citizenship. On the high seas, many British naval officers regarded any seaman who could speak English as a British subject. and that a fortunate sailor could instantly prove American birth from documents in his possession and satisfaction to the press gang, he was forcibly enlisted in His Majesty's Navy. Some of the men seized were unquestionably British deserters. Yet of some 4,000 seized aboard American vessel between 1803 and 1810, protests by United States authorities succeeded in freeing only about 1 in 3. Many Americans served and died aboard British ships of war. In 1806, the British government, by orders in council, declared a blockade of the whole continent of Europe. The year following, Napoleon countered this pronouncement by a counter-blockade by means of the Berlin Decree. Subsequent orders in council and subsequent Napoleon decrees were met by the American embargo of 1807, a measure designed to abolish American farmers altogether as a means of enforcing American rights. The result was not to force Britain and France into compliance, but to bankrupt the American shipping industry and all but drive New England out of the Union. Even before the American embargo, a gratuitous British outrage upon the American flag very nearly precipitated open warfare. When a British warship, the Leopard, halted the United States frigate Chesapeake off Norfolk and demanded the right to search out British deserters alleged to be on the ship's muster roll, the Chesapeake's guns were not mounted. Her crew was newly mustered. Her commodore, James Barron, protested that he could not allow British officers aboard and search an American man of war. The Leopard answered the broadside, killing 3 Americans and wounding 18. Incapable of resistance, the Chesapeake struck her colors. The British boarding party refused to accept surrender but removed 4 seamen. The wave of fury which swept America was calmed only by a prompt British apology and an offer of conciliation. The act of unlawful violence was eventually disavowed by the British government. Barron, however, was brought before a court-martial in January 1808, largely on the initiative of an address drawn by Lieutenant William Allen and signed by 6 officers of the Chesapeake, charging the Commodore with the disgraceful and premature surrender of his vessel. The court presided over by Captain John Rogers and counting among its members such distinguished officers as Bainbridge and Decatur, acquitted Barron of cowardice and most of the minor charges. It did, however, sentence him to a 5-year suspension from the service without pay for neglecting on the probability of an engagement to clear his ship for action. After suspension, he re-entered the American Navy, but his efforts to obtain active service were blocked by the protest of his fellow officers, and he remained upon shore duty until his death. In 1820, embittered by what he considered to be the unjust attitude of his colleagues, Barron sent a formal challenge to Stephen Decatur, whom he accused of being the head of cabal formed by the purpose of persecuting him. The duel took place at Bladensburg. Decatur was killed. Barron himself was severely wounded. Decatur was an immensely popular officer. His untimely death at Barron's hands increased popular and professional feeling against that officer. He was forced to remain on waiting orders for the rest of his life. Nevertheless, British impressment continued on the high seas. British men of war kept their stations off every major American port. A chance night encounter between the American frigate President and the British sloop of war Little Belt very nearly led to war in 1811. The ships exchanged volleys of cannon and musketry in the darkness, and the smaller British vessel was badly damaged. Coming as it did at a period of high tension, received as it was by the Americans, as a welcome episode in revenge of the Chesapeake incident, the President Little Belt encounter added fuel to the long, smoldering fire. Meanwhile, in the far west, Indian troubles aroused Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky. In 1810, war was narrowly postponed. Nevertheless, in the spring of 1811, Indian raids were again a terror along the Wabash. Indian leaders certainly received British encouragement. By midsummer, the southern tribes, Creeks, Choctaws, and Chickasaws, were meeting in council with Tecumseh. Obviously, the frontier was in peril. When in November 1811, General William Henry Harrison broke the major Indian concentration under the Prophet in the hard-fought Battle of Tippecanoe, the West won a momentary respite. Yet when British firearms were found in the Indian camp after Tippecanoe, the West reckoned the full tally of America's enemies. The fall of Forts Mackinac and Detroit to British and Indian forces within a few weeks after the declaration of war, and the Fort Disbon massacre on the day of Detroit's capitulation amply confirmed Western suspicion. Tecumseh was fated to meet death in action as a British brigadier. The situation in Florida was complicated by Napoleon's conquest of Spain. West Florida, comprising what are now the southern portions of Mississippi and Alabama, was disputed territory after the Louisiana Purchase. East Florida, under formal Spanish sovereignty, included the state as we know it. Napoleon's Spanish adventure placed both Floridas in the sphere of British influence in consequence of a Spanish-British alliance. As early as January 1811, Congress secretly adopted a resolution declaring that the United States could not tolerate either of the Floridas passing into foreign hands. Should any foreign power threaten to seize the Floridas, or should citizens of either area express a desire to be annexed, the United States would take possession. Following various intrigues, West Florida was indeed taken over by the Americans under the terms of the Louisiana Purchase. East Florida came under American rule early in 1812 as a result of a show of American force hastened by rumors of a British descent on the region. At the last, there were British attempts at appeasement in the matter of the blockade, but the bitter contentions arising out of impressment, Indian alliances, and the Florida imbroglio had passed beyond diplomatic containment. On June 4, 1812, the House of Representatives voted for war, 79-49. 48 of the 79 affirmative votes came from the South and West, 14 from Pennsylvania, and only 17 from the states of the North. The votes against the war numbered 34 from the North, 2 from Pennsylvania, 13 from the South. On June 18th, the Senate voted 19-13 for war. Again, the division of sentiment followed sectional lines. President James Madison of Virginia signed the joint declaration the day of its passage by the Senate. On June 18, 1812, the United States was at war.
Speaking from the concert stage of the Chicago Theater of the Air, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, has been heard in another of his informative weekly commentaries, presented as a public service feature of this broadcast series. Free copies of tonight's review of events preceding the War of 1812 may be obtained by writing to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago 11, Illinois. Tonight, Chicago Theater of the Air Summer Concert Hour continues as Henry Weber and the orchestra present the Eva Waltzes by Franz Lehár. Thank you. gentlemen, the weekly featured highlight of the Chicago Theater of the Air Summer Concert Hour, Career Performance. This is the thrilling moment in each of these summer concert hours when a new vocal discovery steps before our microphones to make a coast-to-coast bid for future stardom, a first major network career performance. The most successful of these new career performance artists, as judged by your letters and postcards, may well become your favorite radio and television personalities in the years that lie ahead. Your comments are very important to these artists and will reach us care of the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago 11, Illinois. Here to present the career performance of this evening's new vocal discovery is our First Lady of the Chicago Theater of the Air, Miss Marion Clare.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Our career performance guest this evening is Lawrence White, a 25-year-old tenor who was born in Chicago and studied music in this city until he joined the infantry back in 1942. He entered the war as a graduate of Lane Technical High School with a singing career in mind, but little or no experience to back up his ambitions. Strangely enough, the war itself provided experiences for Mr. White that few vocalists would envy. In the Aleutian Islands, he was called upon to sing over an armed forces radio network during a severe air raid, his voice accompanied by bombs exploding about him. As a prisoner of war in Germany, he was forced to sing for the enemy high command. In his own words, it was a case of either singing or being shot. The fact that he is with us tonight testifies to the fact that the enemy must have been favorably impressed. Since the war, Lawrence White has made fine progress in his chosen career. In 1945, he won the Harvest Moon Festival here in Chicago and was rewarded with several local radio programs of his own. Last year, having moved to New York, he was a winner on the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scouts program. Tonight, through the coast-to-coast facilities of the Mutual Broadcasting System, Mr. White is consolidating all his experiences of the past in this endeavor toward national recognition. As he makes this all-important Chicago Theater of the Air career performance, no bombs are bursting and no enemy high command stands ready with a gun. He is singing for the sheer love of singing, and with the hope that your response will keep him singing for many years to come. First this evening, Mr. White is to be heard in the Puccini aria, Che gelida manina, from La Bohème. Lawrence White.
Ti son, non puoi farlo. ecco so fatto. Io, ecco io. La povera famiglia lieta s'allova gran signore. Prima dimmi d'amore,
Gelida Manina from Puccini's La Bohème, presented as the first work in the career performance of Lawrence White. As an encore, Mr. White will sing one of the great tenor melodies from The Merry Widow, Love in My Heart.
Oh,
Ladies and gentlemen, we have presented the career performance of tenor Lawrence White. Your generous letters and postcards can mean much to Mr. White's future. Next week, our career performance guest is to be Dolores De Puglia, young lyric coloratura soprano from New York, who comes to us highly recommended by Eastern critics. We hope you'll plan on participating. For your invaluable help in shaping the careers of these deserving young artists, thank you sincerely.
Thank you, Marion Clare and Lawrence White. Again, our galaxy of summer stars, memorable scenes from the great musical comedy success, Carousel. You'll Never Walk Alone, June is busting out all over, and If I Loved You. Nancy Carr, Bruce Foote, Henry Weber, the chorus and the orchestra. Scenes from Carousel.
Thank you.
of April pride stepped aside the long and pretty way.
They were full of
what a summer by gum, you can feel it come, you can feel it in your heart, you can see it in the ground.
You can hear it in the breeze,
look around, look around, look around.
Directed by Henry Weber, written and directed by Jack LaFrandre, this has been the Chicago Theater of the Air Summer Concert Hour, sincerely dedicated to good radio listening for every member of your family. Our stars this evening were Nancy Carr and Bruce Cook. Our speaker, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. Our career performance guest was Lawrence White. Next week, starring Ruth Slater and Donald Graham. Our career performance guest, Dolores de Puglia. This is Lee Bennett speaking. This is Mutual Broadcasting System.